Welcome back, everybody. Taxation is theft. I know you've heard me say it a million times, and I'll say it a million times again. I have with me today a special guest, Nicholas Landholt, who is an advocate for a militia and an advocate for getting rid of the income tax and abolishing the police state. So without any further ado, welcome. How's it going? Oh, let me, there we go. I got your, well, got your picture on screen. How's it going, Nick?
I've going quite well, Daniel. Appreciate you, you having me on and giving me an opportunity to explain myself to not only the small L libertarians, but big L, capital L libertarians, Republicans, Democrats, whatever.
Where
do you want to start?
We're mostly big L and anarchists here. But we do try to reach outside of that, but I think that's mostly who follows us. So let's first start out with the militia, because I know you're like a broken record with the militia, and that's cool. I actually did a little bit of training with the militia in Texas. And it's a pretty awesome concept, and I think it's very misunderstood, even in the libertarian community. So what's your take on this?
Well, definitely in the libertarian community is, evidence proves of my campaign in 2016 when I ran for Congress. Everyone, you know, once the Libertarian Party of Texas, LP Texas, as Ben Farmer likes to say, and I agree with him. It's a lot of this goes into marketing and branding, and I like LP Texas. It's better than LPTX. But Ben's a good guy in Austin. He actually is from this area in West Texas, Odessa, and moved to the liberal eastern half of Texas, I guess, a few years ago. But I just, you know, I advocated militia, but I'm not talking about private militias. There is a difference between what probably the militia expert scholar in the country is, Dr. Edwin Vieira. Maybe some of the your listeners are familiar with Dr. Vieira, but I first came across him probably about, around 10 years ago, and an article he actually, it was a series of articles he wrote for News with Views on the militia of the several states. And I'm 63 years old, and I had not heard really about well-regulated militia until in my 50s. And that is pathetic. That is, I mean, I couldn't believe what I was reading. And come to find out that I guess they really stopped teaching the Constitution in public schools, I guess, in the 70s. Now, I graduated, actually have a 45th year reunion coming up in San Antonio. I graduated in 73. And I guess in American history, you know, we got something about the Constitution, but as you and I know,
they usually go over it pretty quick. I remember we had a DARE officer come to our class. This is how well they went over the Fourth and Fifth Amendments. They said, if you ever get arrested, don't ask for a lawyer because it makes you look guilty. So,
yeah. Oh, that DARE thing. That's like sex education. You know, you teach the people not to do this, and what do? They do it, you know. but, you know, the whole government school system, which I also want to abolish. We need to get, I homeschooled, actually my wife and I homeschooled our children. Because I knew, even back in the 80s, how bad the public school system was. And we need to get back to either homeschooling or churches. You know, if parents can't, you know, they got to work two jobs. I mean, that's the whole thing with this taxation is theft. They have
families working harder to make up for all the money that the government's taking. Yeah,
exactly.
And actually, that was man, I was watching this documentary. I'm pretty sure it was like a, it was more of a conspiracy theory angle to it. But they said, you know, basically at some point they, before women were in the workplace, somebody said, we're only taxing half of the people. We need to get the rest of these people into the workforce so we can tax them.
Well, have you seen the documentary that Aaron Russo put out, America?
Yeah, Freedom to Fascism.
Freedom to
yeah.
Fascism. Right.
Is that the one where he said it?
Well, he states, now, I'm not sure if he states it in the actual documentary or one of these outtakes, but he says that Nick Rockefeller told him that they funded the whole feminist movement, they meaning the Jewish bankers, the international bankers, whatever you want to call them, and you know, let's make it clear, I'm not bashing on the Jewish people. They're as ignorant as, you know, Catholics. I'm a traditional Catholic, of what's going on behind the scenes as anybody else, like the, you know, your lower degree Freemasons. They don't know what the hell is going on at the top.
Sure.
So these elitists funded the whole feminist movement because, as you say, they knew they were losing out on half of the workforce. So they were looking to destroy the family unit, which for me and a lot of Christians in America is the foundation of society. So, and they've done a hell of a job, as we can see. I mean, parents have no problem shipping their kids off to daycare. I mean, it's getting almost, a mother just giving birth will take maternity leave and zip, you know, 6 months later, she's wanting to get back in.
And what are
and
they teaching your kids? On like they, nobody really, like, this is funny because I've got, you know, my sister just had her second kid a little while ago. I've got, you know, all kinds of cousins and nephews and everything. It's really funny because they don't pay attention as much to what their kids are learning, even in like preschool and daycare and things like this. Like, you know, they're teaching them. They don't even think there's much consequence to things that they do teach them. Like, for example, whether or not to share their toys and that, which is ultimately building a foundation for property rights and all this other stuff. And nobody takes that into consideration, which I think is actually really important, but it's downplayed as, oh, this is completely irrelevant. This isn't even school yet. They're going to grow up and get a full education and they're going to learn all these other things. So yeah, absolutely. And that's something that you don't have control over unless you do homeschool.
Well, and they are funneling these bodies, these drones, human robots, into the job force that they want.
Right.
So entrepreneurship just is out the window.
Right.
And I know libertarians and anarchists and whatever are big on the free market, and that's fine. I like to call it the fair market, but, you know, we can't, you know, free energy should virtually be free. I mean, that's a little story I tell people. I mentioned I'm going to my 45th high school reunion. Well, the high school I went to was Thomas Edison. Well, he was a crook, basically. He stole all that stuff from Nikola Tesla, and who wanted to give the world free energy.
Yep.
But, you know, GE and Westinghouse and all the, you know, they wanted to focus the corporate fascism, you know. So, let's abolish corporate fascism as well. But all of this cannot be done without well-regulated militia. And what happened in 1903 was the Congress at that time, I don't know how long Congress has been bought and paid for, but it's been, you know, over 100 years.
Yeah.
So these guys suppressed all the state militias. I don't know how many states were, you know, around it in 1903, but Teddy Roosevelt and the Congress there, they took away the state militias. They replaced it with the DC, the District of Columbia's militia, which was the National Guard. So now all of a sudden, the National Guard is everybody's, you know, the whole America, the whole Union's militia, and made everybody who was militia age, typically 16, 17 to 45 years old, able-bodied men, we all became unorganized militia, which is an oxymoron.
So, wait, hold on. Explain this for a minute. So I don't mean to cut you off, but explain this for, because I think I'm getting a little bit lost in what's, like, so for one thing, you talked about, I guess you said state versus, what did you say? You said there's two types of militia.
True and false. The true is the public state militias.
Okay.
And the false militias are the private, you know, individuals getting together, which can be easily infiltrated by Fed agents or informants or whatever. Those are not, I mean, obviously, natural right gives us the ability to defend ourselves. Mm-hmm. So if the state is not going to defend you, then yes, these private militias have to, you know, get together. But what's happening is they're infiltrated, as they say, and you have incidences like what happened, I guess, earlier this year in Kansas. The Kansas militia, which is not an official, you know, public militia, it is, you know, infiltrated and is two or three guys are indicted for planning to bomb a mosque.
Right.
The media, the mainstream media has been demonizing the whole concept of militia since the militia Freeman or the militia Montana back in the 90s. And that's because we've had 80 years of being told that, no, you guys aren't militia. You know, these guys, the National Guard and the Texas State Guard, those are authorized militia. And, of course, the dumbing down in the public school doesn't help either.
Right. Yeah, and it's been. I grew up in California, and my view on militia has always been these are some nuts who kind of hang out in the woods and stockpile guns, and they're always planning to overthrow the government.
Exactly.
Yeah. So I want to get this clear, because it sounds like you're saying you don't want private militia, you want public militia. Is that?
Yes, we want what the Constitution says. A well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state. The only thing in the Constitution that it says is necessary is well-regulated militia.
But doesn't that get back to the point about, I get what you're saying about a private militia could be subverted by government agents, but at the same time, a public militia is basically already controlled by public agents from the top down, because it's their organization from the get-go. So it actually
it's a bottom up, because although Congress is authorized to call up the militia, I mean, we're not, that's the other thing, we're not supposed to be having a standing army. I mean, right. The founders completely were against standing armies, because they knew exactly what would happen. And what is happening? Well, we've had standing armies basically since World War I, and now we've got a full-blown police state that, you know, SWAT teams locally, you know, they're buying the military, the armed forces, when their equipment is not, you know, up to date anymore, or they need to
sell it to the local police.
Exactly.
So for one thing, we have it's not supposed to be there aren't supposed to be federal police officers, even though they got the FBI. But that aside, it's almost like all these police agencies are are acting in unison with you know, they're just extensions of the brain that's in Washington D.C. controlling all of this, because they basically say, "Do our bidding, and we'll give you money for, you know, drug war, all this other stuff."
Sure, exactly.
So, but this again goes to this is a public military force, whether you call it a military or a gang or whatever you want to call it. It's controlled by the government. So isn't that, but at the same time, you're saying that is a better type of militia than a private one, which is not controlled by government, but could be subverted by government.
Well, not only that issue of being subverted, but where are private militias going to get the type of arms and weaponry that the public militia is going to have? Because the state militias are supposed to have the same equipment that, you know, as anything else. So,
well,
private militias.
I think that comes down to a Second Amendment issue where, like, you know, there are, you know, what's it called? These companies that manufacture all these tanks and bombs and everything, they're not allowed to sell to civilians because the government says not to. Even the manufacturers of AR-15s and AK-47s, the same manufacturers that sell to the private militias sell to the government the same guns. It's just that the private militias aren't able to buy the fully automatic version because the government says no. So the government is really controlling, you know, what weapons you can buy. So, you know, for you to say, okay, if you want these fully automatic weapons, you need to join the government and then they'll give them to you. But that's one way to look at it. But at the same time is, as soon as you say, okay, I'm going to go my separate way, but I'd like to keep my weapon just in case I'm ever, you know, in case there's ever an issue, you can't take it with you. So it's never really yours. It's the government's gun, and you're only allowed to use it when the government says, that's the enemy, go shoot him. So I think that's really a conflict of interest with the purpose of the militia, which is, you know, the militia is required for a free state. Who is the enemy of a free state? It's a tyrannical government. So right. if you know, the enemy is the person who's arming you and telling and giving you the orders and organizing you and telling you who's the enemy. If your enemy is the one telling you that, you're never going to fight the right enemy, because your enemy's always behind you giving you orders, telling you to basically shoot your neighbor. I think that's kind of a backwards way to look at it.
Well, the way to look at it, though, is if we're talking, and I like to tell people LCS militia, meaning local, county, state militia. If you're in a local militia, which is part of the state militia, you're going to know who your neighbors are. You're going to know who you can trust. You're going to be training with these people. So it's not the government, meaning the federal government, that's going to be telling you. First of all, the federal government can't tell you anything unless Congress calls up the militia. And then the governor, he could look at it and say, well, what are you calling us up for? Okay. To go to Iraq. Well, that's interesting. Where in the Constitution does it say you're going to call up militia and send them over to somewhere? Right. So it starts. That's why I talked about bottom up. If you're local, you've got local officers who are in charge. I mean, and all of these people are, as I say, training together constantly. They are going to know what's going on. If the feds, I mean, right now, the feds call up the National Guard or even state guards, and they do what they're told, right? They have no clue what the hell's going on. You know, hey, we're just following orders. Well, now people, if you got a local militia unit, they are understanding what the hell's going on, and they have the weaponry in case, say, the state calls, well, no, where in the Constitution? That's what we got to get back to, is the Constitution. And this is where I kind of butt heads with various libertarians. I mean, if we just got back to the Constitution, and I'm actually not a fan of the Constitution, I prefer the Articles of Confederation, but if we just got back to the Constitution, how much liberty would we have? Certainly much more than we would have today.
Absolutely.
But that's the difference between your private militia and a state, local, county militia who's training all the time. They have the same weapons as everybody else. I mean, this isn't 1776. It's not musket versus musket. It'd be, you know, AK-47 or AR-15 versus some drone that are drones, you know? And these people have NBC, nuclear, biological, chemical weapons that they can drop to wipe out an area. And, of course, with control of the media, they're already demonizing whoever it is that they need to go bomb. And I'm not talking about overseas. I'm talking about locally. Let's say there was a private militia that of, say, 30, 50 guys. The media can easily demonize, you know, well, I mean, as I just gave the example, there were three guys in Kansas, you know, and we have no way to media bypass this stuff, which is one of the reasons why I wanted to run for Congress again, you know, because there's a, you can actually force FCC licensed station to run ads or to run a paid programming explaining what the hell's going on that the mainstream media would not. So, but as I say, none of this is going to happen unless we have the force of arms, because, and frankly, it may be too late. I don't know. For me, only God knows. But I don't think he's just going to step in. I think he wants to use us, but we got to get organized. So I hope that kind of explains. It's subsidiarity is local control of things, and that's what we got to get back to. We got to know who our neighbors are and who we're training with. Whereas with a private militia, it's like, okay, well, who died and made you in charge? You know, who's going to listen to a private militia? Whereas if you had a local and county militia, and not even necessarily under the county sheriff, I mean, you, if you look at the Texas Constitution, you've got, and I can't, I don't know it off the top of my head. I haven't studied the issue that long. I'm not an expert. I usually defer to either somebody like Dr. Vieira, a piece he's written, or a friend of mine up in Massachusetts, Daniel Vincent McGonigal III, who I tell a lot of my Facebook folks, you know, follow this guy and learn about what happened in 1903 and why things like, you know, Hurricane Harvey or Hurricane Florence, you know, all of this stuff, rather than sending in federal troops or federal, I mean, Katrina was a, that was, you know, they were going house to house and taking arms. And these are like, you know, and that, trial balloons.
That was the National Guard, wasn't it? That was doing that?
Yeah.
So that's
a lot of these government agencies are armed now. So, you know, FEMA, it could be FEMA, if, you know, they have FEMA on the back of their thing and they're carrying around arms.
Well, okay, but let me go back to this for a second, and maybe this is a different example because it's the National Guard, which is the federal level, but so you're advocating for a public militia over a private militia, but you're saying that's what the National Guard was, right? Basically a public militia?
Well, it's public, but it's under the federal government. I'm talking about public militia public, that's so you, under
okay,
the state.
Okay, so you're saying like a public local militia.
Yes, correct.
But wouldn't it what I'm skeptical of is giving that government that power anyway, because just like with the National Guard, so, okay, this is, yes, it's federal, which is different. And they're, you know, they're going door to door collecting weapons unconstitutionally. And let's say that's because those people weren't from that city. So to them, it's like, whatever, this is someone else's city. We don't care.
There you go.
I still think that there's, because government has you know, they get people to follow orders. Like, you know, in California, it's, you know, the police are, you know, they're pretty local, and they're going door to door collecting weapons from certain people that they've deemed unfit to have weapons. So is it really realistic to believe that if you had a public militia, even if it was local, that government wouldn't find some way to justify, to convince the members of that militia to go do something illegal, like collecting weapons from citizens?
Oh, I think it's very possible. And I think you just gave an example.
And isn't that kind of a reason that a private militia would be better than a public, or at least to coexist side by side, so that, you know, if one goes bad, the other one's there, and the people can ultimately decide which one they're going to join, and that's the one that's going to be larger and more powerful.
Well, I mean, that's the thought. Private militia that's works, you know, coordinates with the public local militia. I guess that's something to take a look at. But if the local public militia is going to be corrupt, then the people, the private, is going to be the last defense. Sheriff Richard Mack likes to say that the sheriffs are the last defense, and I say, yeah, no, we the people are. The first three words of the Constitution, we the people. It really does go back to the people answering corruption by being organized themselves. And who knows, why couldn't they be both both the public militia and then have their own private militia in case the public one goes bad? The case of Athens, Tennessee, back in 1946, you had a bunch of returning veterans who stood up against the corrupt county sheriff in the elections that were bringing in, electing people, basically the public officials were going rogue. And so the veterans gathered together when they should have been gathering together as their local militia. But they, as I say, those were suppressed, 40 years earlier. So they just had to band themselves together. And there was actually a battle in the courthouse, outside. And you can see, if you look up Battle of Athens, Tennessee on YouTube, you'll see there's a movie out there on it. But and they ended up, being able to, I don't recall if the feds stepped in and they were able to end the corruption within the county. But certainly there are a lot of corrupt local officials who are going to use the police state that they have in place to try to stay in power. And that's where, if you don't have a local militia, then yes, you would end up having to do a private.
Okay. So let's talk about income tax, because I know you're a pretty big advocate for getting rid of it, as am I, among other taxes. What's your deal with income tax? Let's go there.
Well, you may recall, I'll tell your listeners that Daniel was my first guest. I've got a talk radio show on Fridays called Christian Revolt Long Overdue, and Daniel was my first guest on February 3rd of 2017. I stopped paying federal income taxes back in the 90s when I cut my teeth on Erwin Schiff and, his books. And I realized that, hey, not only do I not owe income tax, I'm not liable for it, but I'm not even liable to file federal income tax. And of course, being from Texas is nice because we don't have a state income tax, right, either. Right. So from 78 to 88, when I was in the military, in the Navy, yes, I was a federal employee. But once I got out, I should have been able to stop paying federal income taxes. Well, I paid for, 8 more years because I didn't know any better. Well, once I knew, I just stopped filing and stayed, kept a low profile. I didn't go around bragging about it. And whenever I took a job from a company that, had withholding taxes, I claimed exempt on line number 7, where it said, were you liable for federal income taxes last year or liable this year? So I always, this is one of what Irwin had said. And of course, Irwin died in jail. They made an example of him. And it's too bad. In fact, I guess I didn't know, but I guess Irwin ran for the Libertarian Party nomination for president back in the day. I guess when he was out of jail.
Yeah.
But it's a shame what happened to him. And so anyway, I just stopped paying. And about 10 years ago, I guess, particularly in 2013, when I started talking about running for governor in 2014 here in Texas, and especially in 2016 when I ran for Congress, and I'll get into that story as to why I ran. But I just told people, hey, I'm not advising you on what to do, but I learned that I'm not liable. And here's some books and here's some websites and here's all kinds of information you can get and decide for yourself. Well, over the last few years, I've decided, we're not going to get anywhere on this income tax unless we have militia. That's the only thing these people understand now is force. And I'm not advocating civil war, but I'm advocating the whole public militia thing. Well, in the IRS pretty much, it sent me a few letters initially in 97, 98 maybe. And then I actually wrote them back and said, would you show me the law? And this was before Bob Schultz and that whole We the People movement that he created in 1999 with Joe Bannister and all of these other, tax honesty movement folks, Larry Beacraft, all these people who had been in this tax honesty movement for years. Now, Joe Bannister, he was an ex. Have you talked to Joe?
Yeah, we
talked
had him on
about
the show.
Joe on your show? Okay.
Last week.
Okay, well, great.
Yeah,
well,
he's awesome.
People know about him. Yeah, yeah. Yeah. And so, he went, he probably explained his story. He went to his bosses after he did research and saying that, hey, these people are right. They don't owe taxes. What's the deal? And they basically told him to resign. Okay, so before Bob's Schultz's movement, and I'm a pretty blunt guy, and I think Bob was controlled opposition, and that goes back to something before he created that tax movement. But I think Bob has been working for the other side for quite some time. But anyway, I said, show me the law, which is basically what Bob Schultz had said. And I never heard from the IRS again until about 5 years ago. And they started sending me letters saying, I haven't filed for 2011, 2012, and I owe this much money, blah, blah, blah. So I went to my congressman here in West Texas, District 11, Mike Conaway. He actually wrote them a letter. And what happened, basically saying that the IRS was harassing me and I wanted him to do something about it. I basically tell him to get up, get him off my back. Well, his regional director, Gloria, I forget her last name, she called and we set up a meeting. I went into downtown Odessa, Texas, and sat down with her. Make a long story short, It lasted about 30 minutes, and it came down to, you know, it came down to, you know, just pay the tax, you know. And I said, okay, thank you very much. And that's when I decided what I was going to run against.
I know what side you're on.
Yeah, right.
Man.
And so, I mean, so the Congress, you know, the Congress is all, you know, afraid of the IRS too. Jim Trakant, well, I'll go back into the 90s, George Hansen, Utah congressman, butted heads with them, and he ended up going to jail. Well, Jim Trakant butted heads with the IRS, and he ended up being fraudulently indicted and went to jail too for 7 years. And what I don't understand, well, here's an example of if Ohio had had a state militia, particularly the militia in Jim Trafficant's district, I think they could have done something. You know, you tell the county sheriffs, this is the situation with the IRS. You know, I don't owe this money, and they say I do. You got to educate the county sheriffs, and that's what I was going to do with my campaign. John McAfee, who ran for the Libertarian nomination for president in 2016, he heard what I was saying, doing on a conference call that we had with Texas delegates, and he said, hey, you know, if you want me to come out and protest with you, let me know. And I talked to John at the convention in Orlando as well. We need somebody with influence who's willing to, you know, speak out about this and educate the sheriffs. And I recently filed a fraud complaint against someone. She calls herself Kripal Beasla. You know, as far as I know, that's her real name. But since my congressman was not going to do anything, as I said, I ran against him. I got a little over 10% of the vote with no campaign. I didn't even open up a bank account. And I would have done the same thing this year too, but I was defeated by someone a guy who doesn't even live in the district ran against me, and he won at the district convention. He got 10, six votes. I got four votes for being there. And that goes back to a liberal faction within LP Texas that I claim set him up, because they knew about me. They knew about my IRS stand. They knew about my militia stand, and they didn't want me around. When we actually had an open district just north of us that he could have ran into, or if they had let me know, I would have run in that district unopposed. He could have ran unopposed here. So that's just a side note. But Kripal Beasla, you know, she's got an Indian accent. She mentioned in one of her letters that their office was it affiliated? Says our office is separate from and independent of the IRS office taking the collection action. We review and resolve disputes in a fair and impartial manner by weighing the facts according to the law and judicial decisions. Well,
because there was this big thing a year or so ago where they said that the IRS hired outside agencies, and they spent something like $100 billion or $10 billion or some ridiculous amount of money. And the amount that the collection agencies hired incidentally collected less than it cost, than, you know, so basically they lost money by hiring this other company to collect money. But this sounds like one of those operations.
That's what I suspect. When I called her, she said, she answered the phone, and I said who I was. And I said, I've got your letter, and, you know, I need to know, can you even show me the law? And she says, well, I'm not in my office. And now, again, an Indian accent automatically gave me the thought that I'm talking to somebody in India. You know, she claims, according to her letters, to be an appeals settlement officer out of Fresno, California. But I get this woman with this Indian accent, or Pakistani, whatever, and she proceeds to say, well, I'm not in my office. I don't have your file in front of me. And I said, well, you know, I want to know what the law is, because you people have never been able to show me the law. Well, anybody who works in the United States has to pay taxes. And so we were around for a minute or two. And I said, okay, well, you know, I want to, and this was all wanting to a collection due process hearing. I've never had an opportunity to go to a collection due process hearing and explain not only the situation, but again, ask them to show me where I owe federal income taxes. Mm-hmm. And she says, well, you have to file your income taxes. Well, they actually,
I don't have call to do shit unless you have a law that says I have to.
Right, right, right. She says, you know, you have to file your actual returns for 2011, 2012 before we give you a collection due process hearing. And I said, you know, what I want to do is I want to record this conversation. I'm going to call you back. No, no, you can't record anything.
That's a quick way to get any collection company off the phone is just say, hey, I'm going to record this.
Well, and I actually started to say, well, I told a little white lie. I said, well, I'm actually recording this. And she hung up.
Yeah.
Now, this was July 23rd. I immediately called her back. I got her voicemail. I said, now, look, I am willing to talk to you calmly about this, but I want to record the conversation. And gave her my number. I never heard back from her until I got another letter. Now, this letter said that during the call on July 23rd, you stated you did not file, did not, I mean, the grammar here is bad. You do not need file or pay any taxes because you are not working for the federal government. Now, get this. When have you ever heard the IRS give you a second chance? She writes, we are providing the one more opportunity, again, grammar problem, to file your self-assessed returns for 2011 and 2012 tax years to replace the returns filed by IRS on your behalf. She stated in a previous letter that the IRS has filed returns for me on my behalf. Thanks a lot. And then she wants self-assessed returns for tax years 2013 through 2017, and that I had until August 30th to reply. Well, the date of her letter is August 9th, but the postmark is August 29th. I did not even receive the letter until September 1st, which was 2 days after the deadline that she gave me.
What year was this?
This is this year.
This year. So there was this. I'm trying to remember. I know it was. What's his name? Dave Champion. Are you familiar with him?
I'm familiar with the name. Yes.
So he's got a series. He does some live videos where he talks about, like, you know, he goes through the tax code. He talks about case history and all this other stuff. And there was a lawsuit a year or two ago where the IRS lost. And they were not allowed to the thing with those substitute files is that they can only be signed by you, or first of all, they're not valid if they're not signed. They can only be signed by you or by the Secretary of the Treasury, and the IRS is obviously neither. Well, obviously not you, and it's not the Secretary of the Treasury doesn't work for the Secretary of the Treasury. So basically all of those substitute returns are invalid. So it's interesting to see that they're still doing something with that. The other interesting thing I can say from my experience with this, 'cause I got a substitute file like maybe close to 10 years ago, is if you ask them for a copy, you know, it's like the social contract. Oh, you signed a social contract. Really? Can I see that contract? I want to know the right. I want to know the exact terms that I signed, right? Exactly. If you ask them for a copy of this substitute return, they won't give it to you.
No.
Which is like, okay, well, and they'll give you like some, they'll give you like some bullshit accounting that's different. But what's really interesting about that is it's almost like, okay, so you have a substitute return, but you're not going to give a copy of it to me. What are you hiding? Right. It's like, this is evidence that's going to be used against me in court. You have a legal obligation to give it to me. And yet somehow you're pleading the fifth and saying, you're not going to give me this evidence. Is there something wrong with it that you don't want me to see? You don't want this to be in my hands. So that's sorry to interrupt your story, but I just think these are some really interesting points so far.
Well, and this is what I brought up to the deputy sheriff when I contacted him to file this complaint. He came out on August 13th, and I, you know, showed him all the paperwork going back to, you know, 2013. And I'll tell you that, as far as I know, the case is still open, and he actually, you know, confidentially said that he didn't know how much the sheriff's department would invest this. But my primary goal was to get this on the record. So I filed a complaint August 13th. On August 14th, September 14th, and this was after I had received this letter after the deadline of August 30th. I called Kerpal. I called her number. I wasn't expecting to get an answer, but I would have loved it if she had. I called her live on my radio show. So I've got that on the public record as well. And I did get her voicemail. I just said, Kerpal, I'm calling you live from my talk radio show, Christian Revolt Long Overdue. And I am calling you about the letter that you sent August 9th, but which I did not receive until September 1st because it was postmarked August 29th. These letters that she has sent, she has not sent through certified mail. She had sent a letter also in July claiming that she sent a letter in June and I didn't respond. Well, I told her I never got that letter. So that's another thing. Usually the IRS on very important things like this, they send them certified mail to make sure you sign off that you've got them. So I didn't, you know, I said, you have my number, you know, please give me a call and let's discuss this. Well, I didn't hear back from her. So last Friday, the 21st of September, I called her again live, but her voicemail was full, so I could not leave a message. But I'm suspecting that, you know, that she really is, like you say, working for some kind of an outside outsourced agency. And, you know, maybe I won't hear anything. Maybe I will. I don't know. But if I do again, because that's what she says, you know, we're going to send you either a letter of determination or a letter of or a decision letter. It says you can petition the United States Tax Court from a notice of determination, but not from a decision letter. Well, she had previously said that they would send a determination letter. So now they're backtracking and saying it's going to be one or the other. And if I receive a notice of determination, disagree with our determination, you'll have 30 days from the date of our determination. I mean, determinations used like 10 times in one pair. I mean, it's just looking very, very suspicious. And so I'm trying to get a copy. I need to go by the sheriff's office, get a copy of the case. Now, the deputy sheriff told me that if it's still an open case, I may just get a cover letter and some and whatever. But that's okay. You know, at least I'll have something and I can fax it to her. And I may call her again this Friday and try again to see if I can get at least a voicemail, because I want to let her know that I have filed a fraud complaint against her, and you know, she needs to send me a letter to say this case is closed.
There's two really interesting aspects to this. First is, you know, we know there are a ton of scams out there. A lot of them are actually in India, and it's not that difficult to forge where a phone call is coming from. So, you know, I can be in India and call you and make it look like I'm calling from the U.S. How do you know for sure that this company, especially since this company is working for the IRS and is not the IRS, how do you know for sure that this agency and what they're claiming is legitimate and not some I don't want to say a real scam, because the government is the IRS is a real scam, but a real non-government scam that's not associated with the real scam? How do you know this? And something else to point out is if this is a valid collection agency, something that I've done that works really well with you know, I've used it on parking tickets and traffic tickets, which I know is, you know, smaller agencies that probably have less of an idea what they're doing. But what they do is when they hand their collections off to law firms, basically these law firms, you know, I threaten them with, hey, you don't have any valid debt, and if you attempt to continue to collect this debt from me under the Fair Debt Collections and Practices Act, I can sue you for every single time you send me a letter in the mail, or every single time you give me, you know, you call me on the phone. And that usually makes them disappear really, really quick. So I'm wondering, yes, if you can use that tactic with this agency that you're dealing with, because the reality is, if it's the IRS that's harassing you and you take them to court, the judge is obviously going to take the IRS's side. But if this is a collection, yes, company, it's a private corporation, and when you sue them, the courts are not going to see them as the IRS. They're going to see them as a private corporation, and they don't have that same protection that the IRS would have in operating their scam. So, and I think that's the reason that these letters are so much more effective against these private companies, because they see that shit and they're like, hey, somebody's going to sue the government and we're going to get caught in the middle of this. We don't want any part of that. And usually what they do is they'll kick that file back to whatever agency gave it to them and say, hey, we don't want to mess with this guy because he's talking about lawsuits and stuff. If you want to deal with it, you deal with it. And, you know, if the IRS is, you know, short on manpower and they're outsourcing all this stuff, it might go back into a pile that just never gets, nobody ever gets to it. So it's one tactic to consider with this whole thing. But yeah, the reality is,
well, the issue.
Yeah, go ahead.
No, go ahead.
I was going to say, like, the way that they're dealing with this is, it's really common, and I've seen it, and it's this implied consent is what they call it when you sign for your driver's license. So whenever you get stopped by the police, you have waived most of your Fourth and Fifth Amendment rights because you have implied consent to certain searches, and for example, blood draws and breath tests for DUIs. You have already consented to those by signing for your driver's license. And so you, in the same way, the government has this thing in their legal system where, it's like, they'll send you a letter and they'll say, well, I sent him a letter, so he knows. And, you know, like you said, they didn't send it certified, so there's no way for them to prove that, you know, but hey, you didn't respond. We're just going to assume that, you know, and we're going to proceed as if you knew. And hey, we did our quote unquote, due diligence. And you know, if later this comes up in court, well, they never sent the letter to me, well, then okay, they can backtrack the whole case and we can walk through, okay, so you didn't respond, how do you respond right now? And they'll give you the opportunity to respond to it, and of course, you know, your assets are already frozen, like, you know, you're still in this mess, and now they're saying, okay, well, how do you respond to this? And there's not really, like, however you respond, they're just gonna say, oh, well, that doesn't really change anything. So, you know, and then they're just gonna railroad you and say, you know, okay, none of that matters. We're already here and we're just gonna keep going the way that we are. So the reality is you you have to, you know, even like when they send you a letter and you may or may not have received it, if there's something that they can do next based on that, then they're going to try to do that and use that letter as justification. And actually a letter that I, not a letter, a sign that I saw that's actually very similar to this, which is it's very much like that implied consent thing, but it was like a, it was a sign that someone put on their door that said, attention, it was like, attention, Jehovah's Witnesses. I charge $50 per minute to listen to any sort of, you know, sales pitch or whatever, and you agree to these terms by ringing my doorbell. Now, somebody can go ahead and ring the doorbell, and of course the person can say, well, I didn't see the sign, and, you know, if this went to court based on, you know, the precedent that the government uses with these letters and everything, basically what it's going to come down to is, well, you should have seen the sign. And you know, it's the same thing with, you know, oh, you ran the stop sign. I didn't see it, officer. It doesn't matter. It was there. You consented to it.
Right.
It's really kind of nonsense in a way, but, and it kind of makes sense because, you know, okay, well, I mean, what can you do? If you put a sign in front of your door that says, don't do something, and someone does it, it's like, what do you expect to do as a human being? Sit in front of your house the entire time and, you know, in case somebody walks by and say, oh, no trespassing. You know, that's a waste of your time. And it's stupid to think that someone should be able to do that. So, but at the same time, should the consequences be artificially or implicitly consented to the extent that you can violate somebody's rights in return? That's a completely different question. But that's the question that the government likes to kind of dance around with these letters. So they'll continue to just send letters and then say, well, we sent this letter and he didn't respond. And they'll probably even not send it certified on purpose so that maybe you just think it's junk and you don't open it. And you know, so that 30 days later you find out your bank account's been frozen and it's the point of no return. There's nothing you can do at that point. You can't even hire a lawyer to sort it out for you.
Right, right. Well, I've kept Larry Beecraft, who's one of the more famous, I guess. I think he was involved in Joe Bannister's defense. I know Robert Bernhoff, a tax attorney out of Austin, Texas. I know there's a YouTube clip of he and Joe being talked to by Alex Jones about the Joe Bannister's case. But I've tried to keep Larry informed. The thing is, with these letters, some of the letters have the IRS logo, which it does not look as sharp as some of the other, you know, certified IRS letters I've had.
Xeroxing their own stationery.
Right, yeah. some of the letters just have don't have the logo, just have Internal Revenue Service, Appeals Office, P.O. Box 24018, Fresno, California.
Right.
So
they
that's why
don't
I need
have signatures
to get
on them either.
Copy it. Right. Well, this one is
or
not. It looks like some kind of a copied, not an actual signature.
Yeah.
All of the ones I've gotten. And probably what I need to do is, since Larry isn't communicating with me for whatever reason, I need to get a copy of that fraud complaint and go ahead and send it back to her and say, you know, are you with the IRS or not? And, you know, I'm going to continue to pursue this if you do not send me a letter saying, you know, we've decided you don't owe anything, blah, blah, blah. If you're really with the IRS, but
right.
I mean, this is what obsessed me about, and I know we're running a little over time. This is what obsessed me about the Libertarian Party. I've been talking about this issue since 2015 when I joined, and they don't care.
Yeah,
you and I both know they came out of the Orlando National Libertarian National Conference with this, you know, taxation is theft. It was a resolution that they passed or whatever. And what have they done about it? Nothing.
Yep.
And I'm hammering on them, and they don't like it, and the people in Texas don't like it, but I don't give a damn. I'm going to keep harping about it because you could be the party to get this whole thing settled. You could be getting millions of people coming over to your side because you're the party who's taking on the IRS.
Yeah. And that's one of the positions I'm taking with my presidential campaign. But here's the thing, like I'm kind of separating my campaign from the Libertarian Party because of that. Like I know, as far as our ideals, I think they're very different. They're very similar. There's a lot of common ground, but the Libertarian Party, I think, likes to focus on things. They like to focus on the broad picture of, yes, everything we do needs to be a step towards liberty, which is great, and that's, you know, that, I mean, it's true. But at the same time, you know, the core of all of these government programs that are stealing our liberties and our privacy and everything else is taxes, but most it's prominently money, right? The income tax, because that is what this is, how, you know, the Pentagon loses like $5 trillion every year. Like, they just misplace it somehow. Where does that money come from? The income tax. There's the NSA is building these massive server storage systems, which are tapped into all the internet backbones, so they can download all this metadata and listen to all our phone calls. How do they pay for that? With the income tax. The drug war has they spent what, $1 trillion over the past 30 or 40 years. Where do they get that money? The income tax. If you get rid of the income tax, you get rid of most of these programs. And it's like, you know, people just, but they don't want to go there, because it's almost like, as much as they say, you know, as much as they're pro Second Amendment and they're proud of about all these guns that they have, they are scared to death of the IRS and they're afraid to say anything about it.
Right. I completely agree. And I've thought about, you know, throwing my hat in the ring too. But I'm looking for a campaign manager and a marketing company that wants to take on an issue that would be the most controversial issue in any presidential campaign.
Yeah, I absolutely think that's right. And next to legalizing pineapple pizza, of course, because that's my headlining issue. yeah, but it's yeah, we need to shut down these anti-pineapple pizza bigots. They're terrible people. but yeah, it really is. And I mean, I've talked to I asked Nick Sarwark because he's, you know, he's the national chair. I respect his opinion for just about everything. And I asked him about, you know, his position on this, and his position is kind of like, you know, taxation is theft, of course. So he's not a fan of taxes, but that, you know, he's basically got the same, he's got the same thing that, like, yeah, you know, we shouldn't really join this with this tax protest movement, because the tax protest movement, ultimately, a lot of these people end up in jail. And, you know, whether they're, and, you know, he said it, whether they're correct or not, meaning, you know, and I kind of agree with him on this, that you know, because he says the law might say that you don't owe the tax, but if the IRS is going to file a case against you and they're going to have corrupt judges and they're going to figure out a way to get their money anyway, then that is something to be afraid of. And I agree with him on that. Whether we just submit to it or do whatever we can to fight it is a completely different story.
That's where I think if he united the party on that issue, I mean, I have to laugh, because the biggest thing that came out of New Orleans, the national convention in New Orleans, was, you know, the plank about the sex workers.
Yeah.
I mean, come on, are you kidding me? Gadzooks.
Yeah, it's, yeah, and why isn't it, no. and the IRS? Why wasn't, and I guess that, I guess I dropped the ball on that one, because I should have nominated that as a resolution, but It's you know, a few years ago it was end the Fed when Ron Paul was really pushing that, and he wasn't right. even in the Libertarian Party, and or not at the time anyway, and then that just kind of fizzled away. I mean, there are still some people who go around saying it, but it's not the big issue. And I understand, so there's this aspect to it too, right? The Libertarian Party is, they're trying to connect with more of a mainstream audience by kind of like taking this middle of the road approach where, you know, oh yeah, we're going to, you know, we're going to be, we want to attract the LGBT community. We want to attract, you know, the Democrats. We want to attract the Republicans, which is fine, I think, but I don't think, my perspective is on my perspective on
there's
that is
a,
this.
There's such a small fraction, though.
Yes.
Income tax crosses everything.
Exactly. But I think, and this is my approach. Like, you can say, okay, let's take LGBT, right? You can take this relatively small group and you can say, we're going to fight really hard for a specific set of rights, which is only going to affect your relatively small group, or which basically then says, you know, okay, we're going to take all of our energy and we're going to focus on you know, helping a small group versus, and you know, don't construe this to mean I don't want to help that group, versus what my position is to say, no, we have a bigger enemy to fight, which is the income tax, and once we get rid of the income tax, this is going to help the LGBT group this way. You know, so we have, let me pick another example where, you know, it's the effects are more realized, which would be people who have serious medical conditions. Let's take diabetics. We could come up with some party platform that says we're going to be the party for diabetics, and we're going to create this new program, and it's going to save all the diabetics. It's going to somehow, you know, we're going to find a way that's libertarian that's going to help save diabetics. We can create that program. That is going to divert all of our energy into basically coming up with this program and implementing it and making it happen. That's going to take all of our energy away from fighting the income tax, versus what my strategy would be is to say, forget all that. We're going to get rid of the IRS. Once we get rid of the IRS, the FDA is going to be less powerful. When the FDA is less powerful, there will be less of a monopoly on the production of insulin. When there is less of a monopoly on the production of insulin, the cost of your insulin will go down. You, the diabetic, will benefit from this program. And anybody that you talk to, anybody, no matter who it is, the $15 minimum wage, you want a living wage? Let's talk about that. We can take all of our energy and divert it towards raising the minimum wage to $15, which isn't even libertarian in the first place, but we can, you know, whatever the libertarian program might be to make that happen, we can figure that out. Or we can say, look, if we get rid of the income tax, your paycheck as a minimum wage worker is going to just about double.
Exactly.
Because you're not going to be, the government's not going to be stealing from your paycheck, and your employer is not going to be paying their taxes on top of your paycheck, which could go directly into your pocket. And so now they can afford to pay you double. Without costing them anything else.
And employers are going to be thrilled because they are no longer going to be unpaid agents of the IRS.
Exactly. How much money are they going to save by not, you know, by not having to do like extra CPAs to like go through all this ridiculously extra meticulous work and everything else? They're going to say, and yeah, a lot of people are going to be out of a job from that. But guess what? We're going to create more jobs in other ways because there's going to be less regulation in industries that really don't need to be regulated, that never should have been regulated in the first place, like cutting hair of all things. This is my perspective on it. If we focus on the core of the problem, like we're like government is a cancer. We're not going to start treating the cancer by clipping off little fuzzballs growing on the side of the outside of the cancer. We're going to remove the entire thing. And at the core of that is the IRS and the income tax. That is a huge part of it. Once that's gone, we'll start seeing a lot of these problems solve themselves, and we'll start getting a lot of people from the left and the right to join us in that, as long as they can see the benefit for themselves. Because ultimately, that's what everybody wants to know. What's in it for me, right? That's who they're voting for, the person that's going to give them what they want. Everybody benefits from this. You just have to show it to them. And if you would focus your energy on showing that to them instead of trying to figure out one specific little program to really cater to them, like, they're all going to be happy. Everyone's problems are going to get solved, and you can focus on one big picture, real solution that's going to make some real change.
Scripture says that the love of money is the root of all evils. And why, I mean, Libertarian Party doesn't even, you know, every time I bring up Christian stuff, I'm told you need to go to the Constitution Party, or you need to, you know, the conservative Republicans. They're over in that, you know. Hey, if I give you economic freedom, it doesn't matter what I'm spouting religious-wise. You now have money in your pocket that you can invest or use however you want. If we don't get economic freedom, we're going to continue to be slaves.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's I'm totally with you on that. It's that's that needs to be a bigger focal part. But anyway, so that's
And you know, actually, the IRS, we don't. It's a nice political soundbite to say I want to end the IRS. No, we just need to apply the income tax correctly.
That's arguably, yeah, but that would be a good start. Let's say that.
The majority of Americans do not owe federal income taxes, and they will have, like you say, almost double their paycheck, and they'll be happier. I mean, you go around and all these service employment places, these people, they're not happy. You can see they're not happy. You give them more money, and I think you'll see smiles on their faces.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's everybody feels like they're getting robbed. It's yeah. Here's another issue I think contributes to that, which I really want to integrate into my platform, but that's just to motivate people to improve their own lives, because I went through this transformation myself, where I went through all these schools that were, you know, basically I wanted to be an entrepreneur when I was a kid, and I tried it. I tried it in school. I tried selling candy bars in school, and I was punished for that. The system wants us to be a part of the system, and that's not natural. It's not what we like. My friend posted on Facebook today an article about post-vacation depression, because he just took a vacation trip to New York. He came back and he got depressed, and then he found an article that said, oh, it's not just me. I thought I was alone in this, which is, for one thing, why do people feel alone with their like, am I the only person who feels like this? There's no sense of community where, like, you can talk about your how you feel in certain things. There's no sense of self self-worth. I think our self-worth, that's not something they teach you in school. No. How to value yourself. I mean, they talk about right. Self-esteem and shit, and like, oh, it's bad to have low self-esteem. That was kind of like the most that I ever got when I was in school. And it's like, okay, how do you have a high self-esteem? How do you believe in yourself? How do you learn to go out and take a risk to do something to follow your dreams? That's something that most people don't follow, and why they just graduate school and say, okay, well, the next thing that I'm supposed to do, according to the formula for my life that somebody else wrote, is get a job. And so they get a job, and it doesn't feel right, because that's not what they should be doing. They should be going out and exploring the world and figuring out how to live the life and follow their dreams. And not enough people do this. And I think that is I don't know exactly even how to work this into my campaign, but that is a huge part, because, you know, that's we have all these people complaining about the minimum wage isn't high enough and all this other. Well, get out of that job. You know, it's really not that difficult. And I've been accused of poor shaming. It's a new thing. Because I tell people you can do better. I'm not shaming them. I'm telling them you can do better.
Right.
And right. I get accused of demonizing them when it's like, no, I'm trying to get everybody to realize that you're worth more than you value yourself. And once you realize that, you can grow out of it. And that solves the minimum wage problem. It comes from within. But if you're not willing to do that with yourself, you're kind of, you know, shooting yourself in the foot.
Well, you know, I'm a big advocate too of Frederick Bastiat's The Law,
mm-hmm.
and I'm ashamed to say that I only just recently read it. I mean, as I say, I'm 63 years old, and I should have read this thing 20 years ago, but my copy is from the Foundation for Economic Education, and it says the classic blueprint for a free society. Well. I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but, you know, libertarians are talk a lot about this little book that was published in 1850. And, you know, that's what I'm going to start advocating a little bit more is we got to get back to the law, which in short is organized justice. Well, in order to get justice, you have to end injustice. And this whole money situation is unjust, and that's why I'm pushing the militia.
Absolutely. All right. Well, I'd love to keep talking about this more, but I think we're at time. We're past time. We've gone over.
Sure.
But it's really been great talking with you. I think these are all interesting points, and we'll have you on again sometime. And is there anything you wanna plug as far as websites?
Well, I just if everyone's interested, I've got my Facebook page, Landholt for Congress, is actually a political organization. So if anyone, you know, likes what they heard today and they want to help, you know, move this thing forward, you know, contact me through Facebook. As I said, Landholt for Congress. It's LANDHOLT. And just contact me and I'll tell you more. I mean, I'm working with another organization as far as the whole militia concept thing. But I'm not an organizer. I'm a guy with ideas. But we need to find somebody with some capital to organize, to help organize, to put a team together and make a difference by, as I say, doing an in run around the media by using the media.
Absolutely. All right.
Appreciate you having me.
Absolutely. Daniel. Anytime. Yeah. So it's taxation is theft. We'll see you next time.
Exactly.